From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. Thank you so much. Please visit stateofbelief.com and then help keep this show on the air. Now, here's where we're going during the next hour.
Whenever you say interfaith education or multi-faith education, people go, oh, yeah, right, that thing. But everyone has an interfaith or a multi-faith education. It is just a very bad education for most people.
As America grows ever more diverse, both ethnically and religiously, it's natural for our young people to come into contact with others from vastly different backgrounds. While there's tremendous value to these everyday interactions, there's also a pressing need for focusing on both the challenges and the opportunities of this new world in a structured and organized way. On this week's show, you'll hear about one such effort, the nation's first fully accredited interfaith high school.
We need all of God's help we can get, and I don't think we're exactly setting ourselves up for his favor.
This is essentially man shaking his fist in the face of God saying, I don't need you.
With progress on marriage equality continuing in parts of this country, there are many who continue to see this as a sign of secularism triumphing over religion. Well, of course, many millions of Americans support marriage equality, not despite, but because of their faith convictions. But an article posted at theweek.com recently takes it one step further. The headline reads, How Christianity Gave Us Gay Marriage, and the author Damon Linker will be with us on this week's State of Belief Radio.
This whole business of academic freedom that the Discovery Institute has launched is totally fraudulent.
Earlier this month, a South Dakota bill was withdrawn that would have made it illegal to stop teachers from teaching intelligent design and other related topics. That's a quote, alongside evolution. But it may well be back in another form. And in other states, from Virginia to Missouri to Louisiana to Texas to a number of others, the assault on science continues. A broad legislative proposal to free teachers in Oklahoma to identify as controversial such science as evolution and climate change is currently in line for consideration, and South Carolina has a similar bill potentially awaiting action. For an update on this movement, I'm joined by my good friend Zach Coplin, whose work to, as he puts it, repeal creationism has long made headlines in his native Louisiana and beyond. Zach, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Hey, Welton, thank you so much for having me on.
This anti-science stuff is just lurking around every corner, it seems like. Zach, how are things going on the pro-science side of the battle?
So this year is actually really interesting because it's been the first year that I've ever been involved in this where we've really managed to see what's happening on the ground when you have anti-science legislation passed. And so we have a creationism law in my home state, Louisiana, and I'm currently living in Texas where there are curriculum standards that allow sort of the controversy to be taught, teaching all sides of evolution. They want all sides of the fossil record taught, which is not science. There's not all sides of the fossil record to be taught. You teach about the fossils. You teach about how life has changed and adapted over time. You teach evolution in science class. So there's not an all sides to be taught.
Mm-hmm.
And so now what we're seeing in Texas, the largest charter program in the state, I've been working on this, is actually teaching creationism in their classes and justifying it under the all sides provision of the Texas curriculum standards. And in Louisiana, there's actually been a court case where creationism is being taught in Sabine Parish, Louisiana, among other things that just sort of are straight up child abuse. The ACLU is suing over that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see there's anti-science legislation that causes problems on the ground. And it's not just a Louisiana or Texas thing, as you mentioned. We had a bill in South Dakota that's been killed now, which it was one of the silliest bills this year. I think it was titled the Prevent administrators from like preventing the instruction of intelligent design bill. And something like that is never going to pass. Creationism is no longer allowed directly into schools. But the way you see creationism these days is through these self-legislation, like Louisiana, Tennessee, and in Texas, where it allows all sides, where it allows the controversy, where it allows critiques of evolution to be taught. And that's sort of what we're seeing, is these type of bills are being introduced all over the country to critique established science and use that as a weasel word to get creationism into the classroom.
What states are you most concerned about during this legislative season?
So the state that is always most concerning every year is Oklahoma. We've seen about two bills introduced in Oklahoma to attack science education per year, and we've been seeing that for almost 15 years now. I think they've averaged two bills a year, and it comes close every year to passing. And so right now we have a bill that would prevent teachers from, as the NCSC says, the National Center for Science Education says, prevent administrators from stopping teachers from miseducating students about scientific controversies. We have the Louisiana Science Education Act, which was originally known as the Louisiana Academic Freedom Act, that passed in my home state. This is called the Science Education and Academic Freedom Act. And it's always worrying because Oklahoma, this could pass, and then we could suddenly have a third state. There's been an Academic Freedom Act passed in Louisiana and Tennessee. Mm-hmm. We have a third state now that has a creationism law, and that would be really, really scary to me.
Zach, in your work with parents and educators at the local level, what do you find to be the most effective way to raise concern and inspire people to get involved in getting this thing right? What do you tell them the stakes are?
The best way to get people inspired is actually less about what I say and more about what's happening in their classrooms. And so when you have a parent who lives in a state with an academic freedom bill that allows creationism to be taught in the classroom, they're going to be much more upset when they realize what that actually means and what their kids might be learning. And it's hard to speak directly to children. That's the problem. It's hard. But if there's any kids listening to this, if you're being taught creationism in your public school classroom, go tell your parents, tell your teachers, call the ACLU, because it's not legal. And we know this is a number I want to stress, because it's actually, of all things you mentioned, it's the scariest thing to me. Whether or not there's creationism laws in these states, 13 to 20%, somewhere around there, of teachers are actually teaching creationism directly in public school science classes in schools all across the country. It doesn't really, there's not that much of a dramatic difference between Louisiana and New York, or Minnesota, or you'll see teachers all across the country teaching creationism. And also, even more scarily, on top of that, 13% who are teaching creationism, another 60% aren't teaching evolution fully, or they're trying to balance both sides, or they're afraid to teach evolution, or they don't know enough about evolution to teach it. And so our students are really being miseducated, and creationism is either being directly taught or the door is being left open in the majority of our public schools. And that's a really scary thing. So whether or not there's legislation on the ground, parents and students really need to figure out what they're being taught in science class and whether it meets curriculum standards, whether it violates the law, whether they could be getting a better education. And then they need to take action. They need to call their school board and ask to be taught evolution. They need to call the National Center for Science Education if they need help to actually make sure that their teachers are teaching the right thing. Call the American Civil Liberties Union. Call Americans United for Separation of Church and State. I can say things. I can tell people about what's going on. But it's up to them to realize it affects their life and that they need to take action.
That is so well said. I found very disturbing a recent Pew poll that shows a third of Americans refusing to believe in evolution. Now, you know, I understand the selfish nature of business interests that don't want to take responsibility for their role in global climate change. So at least there's a self-serving component in denying that. But what do you see as the motivation behind opposing the teaching of evolution?
It's often a misunderstanding about first what evolution is, because there's very many people who can accept the evidence behind evolution and also have their faith. Millions and millions of people do that. It's certainly not impossible, but most people first don't realize what evolution is, which is just, it's the best scientific explanation we have for the diversity of life on Earth. That's all it is. It says nothing about the supernatural, but many people are afraid, especially if you take a very literal interpretation of a holy book, they're afraid that if they accept evolution and accept that that the Earth has been around for 4.5 billion years and that animals have changed over time and species have evolved, they think that's a threat to their beliefs and they can't accept it. And so that's a big problem. Is you can accept evolution, you can have faith. The Catholic Church does that. Many mainline Protestant organizations do that. But some people just haven't been able to accept that. And I think the more you understand evolution, the less scary it is in terms of that regard. But many people aren't being taught evolution. They don't have a basic idea of what it even is. I get silly questions like, well, why are there still monkeys if we came from monkeys?
Yeah.
It's sort of such a basic misunderstanding of evolution that the general population has that no wonder they're afraid of it. Yeah. And no wonder they don't like it.
But you know, Zach, I honestly, as a minister and a pastor for well over 50 years, I tend to see the people who are so afraid of evolution and even the theory of evolution, I see them as having a very insecure faith, a very weak faith, if they don't think that their faith can withstand the truth of science, then something's wrong, because we ought to be in a partnership, not a competition.
Yeah, I've said the same point where it's not necessarily even relevant. Like,
right.
If you have your faith, you can still accept the way the world works.
Exactly.
And our understanding of the world.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing. It's science isn't actually what's happening. Science is our explanation. It's the best explanation that we've tested and retested over and over again. And that's just the way it works. All it is an explanation, and it will change and adapt over time. People take it as much more than an explanation, and they take it as an ideology, they take it as a religion. And it's like, or people seem to think that science would be that. And it's not just an explanation of the natural world. That's all it ever claimed to be. And it helps us learn and invent things and live better.
Well, listen, I've been wanting to ask you a question, particularly you, that there was a memorable moment during the Bill Nye Ken Ham debate a couple of weeks ago that really stood out for me when Nye said, when Nye said there are trees that are older than creationists say the universe is. What were you thinking during that whole debate?
It was pretty terrible for me to watch. It's my job to watch it, so I had to watch it. But it was clear that Ken Ham's creation model did not stand up to reality, and the evidence wasn't there. And I mean, the one line about the trees was one of the big points illustrating it.
Yeah.
Another one, it demonstrated creationism wasn't science. And the whole point was asked, well, what would it take you to change your views? And could you, if the evidence were there, theoretically accept another model? And of course, Nye said, as a scientist, what the evidence says, I'll go by. That's how scientists work. You retest, and then you go with the evidence.
Right.
On the other hand, Ham just said, there is a book. And he just said that over and over and over again.
Yeah,
and it just illustrated the point that it's not science. It doesn't belong in a science classroom.
That's right.
It's perfectly fine if you believe that on your own outside of science classrooms. But when Nye agreed to the debate with Ham, a lot of people in science advocacy who work on evolution were upset because you don't debate creationists because it gives them false legitimacy and it makes it look like they're actually on an equal playing field, which is wrong. But the point that Nye made and the point I agree with is that this isn't about whether creationists have false legitimacy and we're adding to it. Already, nearly 50% of the population, by some polling, by Gallup, is creationist. And they are always trying to put it in science classrooms. You cannot separate just the debate over creation and evolution from the attempts to put it in science classrooms. That's actually a big problem. I think that's the issue here. Ken Ham isn't just trying to tell people about creationism in his museum. And the Discovery Institute isn't just trying to inform people about intelligent design through their think tank. They all actively want students to learn it.
Right.
And that has to be always remembered every time we talk about this issue.
Well, and that makes me want to tell you again, I've told you before, how pleased I am about the work that you're doing and grateful for it. I want you, before we go, to say just a word about what you've got in front of you in the coming year in dealing with this thing.
So we've been trying to repeal the Louisiana Science Education Act for 3 years. We're going to be back in the spring. My attention, though, right now is actually, I briefly mentioned how the largest charter program in Texas is teaching creationism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of my big projects. I learned about this program, the Responsive Education Solutions Charter Network, last fall from Johnny Scaramanga, an education activist in the UK who works on the accelerated Christian education curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been sent by a parent something that some of their curriculum that really resembled the ACE homeschool curriculum.
Mm.
He put that in Salon. It got on my radar. And I started investigating. It became very clear that this program is just, it's creationist. It teaches bad history, too. The worst thing that I think I found in these books, there's a section where they teach the samurai were responsible for Japan's involvement in World War II, which is just flat out wrong because the samurai were disbanded almost 70 years before World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And so factual errors, it's religious indoctrination. I actually visited one of the schools yesterday, and there were 11 crosses in the principal's office. The school itself is leasing its building from a church, and the auditorium that they use is also the church sort of place, like the place where they have sermons, and there's this big sign and glowing neon bulbs that says God over the door to what's essentially their auditorium. And so it's clearly a religious school network posing as secular, receiving public money, receiving 17,000 students. It's the largest program in Texas. It has schools in Arkansas and Indiana, and it's just growing. And so I think this program needs to be shut down. The charters need to be given to schools that actually are good.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be what I'm working on right now, is fighting to make sure that we replace the charter for responsive ed in Texas with charters for schools like KIPP, which actually teach students reality.
Really glad you're at it. Zach Coplin started his advocacy for science education while still in high school in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He continues to be an articulate activist and an example of the difference one person can make when committed, really committed to a cause. Zach, I appreciate the update. I always enjoy talking with you. Go get them.
All right.
Thanks for being with us again, Zach.
Yeah, it's always so much fun to talk.
As broad segments of this country move rapidly toward an acceptance of marriage equality, the issue continues to be a lucrative organizing and fundraising tool for some on the far right. Now, sadly, as you would predict, this almost always gets done in the name of religion. Some say the impulse toward equality is a sign of a secular triumph over religious convictions. But my next guest wrote compellingly on theweek.com that, in fact, it is a very long-term characteristic of faith, specifically Christianity, to promote equality and fairness for ever more people, regardless of the relatively short-term detours that have come on the road to justice. It's an optimistic message, to be sure, and I wanted to meet the author and share his thoughts with you. And so I'm very happy to welcome Damon Linker to State of Belief Radio. Damon, glad you're here.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Your headline is How Christianity Gave Us Gay Marriage. So let me start with that question. How did it give us gay marriage?
Well, in the column, I rely on very heavily on the arguments of Alexis de Tocqueville, the famous Frenchman who came to the United States in 1831 to see the new democracy in this country and wrote the famous two-volume book, Democracy in America. And in the introduction to that book, it struck me that there are some passages that can be used to understand where we are today on this issue. And Tocqueville's main argument is that what he was living through at the time and we're still living through today is a kind of revolution of democratic or equality as a principle, democracy and equality. And that the principle of equality, Tocqueville thought, was leveling aristocracies, getting rid of all kinds of hierarchies, and transforming the world in its image. and that this principle of equality ultimately traces back to the most radical teachings of Jesus Christ in the Sermon on the Mount and other passages of the Scripture, where Jesus talks about the last being first and the first being last and the meek inheriting the earth. And similar passages about the equal dignity of all human beings and us being made in the image of God. All of these things put together created a kind of dynamic that we've been working out in our civilization for the last 2,000 years. And Tocqueville thought it was sweeping the world in his time, creating the new democracy in America, creating the French Revolution in France, and then sweeping the rest of the globe. So it struck me that I wondered, you know, could we think this through and try to understand this very disturbing for many people move toward gay marriage as just the latest outgrowth in this continuing revolution of equality that Tocqueville talked about. So that's what I try to explain in the piece.
I personally think you can make the argument about equality from Tocqueville or from Jesus. But how do you respond to people who, out of their understanding of Christianity, say equality is not a factor if you're talking about the immorality of homosexuality?
Well, it is, of course, a complicated issue, and I have respect for believers who take that position as long as they're willing to speak civilly and not be inappropriate in
right.
their anger about it. I'm happy to debate that. I mean, clearly, if you're a Protestant, what Tocqueville is saying, it doesn't sound quite as radical. If you're an Orthodox Roman Catholic or an Eastern Orthodox Christian, it sounds perhaps a little more outlandish.
Mm-hmm. Because
those Christian traditions are more explicitly anti-equal. They're more hostile to equality, and they tend to advocate a little bit more of a kind of elaborate moral teaching about sexuality that is often incompatible, it seems, with gay marriage. But I would say in response that it doesn't really matter what faith tradition as a Christian you come from. If you read the teaching in the Bible, it's very hard to read those passages especially the Sermon on the Mount, and not see them, as I put it in the column, as one of the most subversive teachings in human history. And the fact is that a lot of change for the better in human history has come about as a result of trying to apply those Christian principles more strictly.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a reason why modern liberal democracy arises in the West as opposed to any other civilization in history. It happens, in my view, because of the Christian legacy in the West. It's an attempt to, in some ways, ever be more accurate in applying what Jesus was advocating. Tocqueville himself was very disturbed about some of these changes that he was seeing. He was himself an aristocrat, and he realized that the privileges he enjoyed as an aristocrat were ending, that in the world that was being born in his time, people like himself would not really find a place. And yet he accepted it, even though it sometimes, inspired what he called religious terror in himself, because he realized that the new world, however scary it might be, is more just than the one that came before.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, that's why equality always wins, because in the end, those who oppose it can't find compelling moral arguments to defend their side, and in the end, they therefore lose.
In the beginning, you contextualized Tocqueville's comments very well by looking at what was going on around him, and there were many efforts to establish equality. Talk, if you will, just a little more about that compelling march of equality, and just to refer to what you just said, how at times it looks like this is destiny, moving toward equality.
Yeah, well, Tocqueville sketches very briefly, because it's just the introduction to the book, but he sketches a kind of brief history of the last 2,000 years in which he says, look, you have Christ who teaches this teaching that sounds like a doctrine of radical equality before God of all human beings. But this was promulgated throughout the ancient world, spread around and so forth, in a world that was itself very hierarchical, the ancient Roman world of the Roman Empire. And these teachings were absorbed into this aristocratic culture, and what you ended up with for about 1,000 years was a strange amalgam of Christian moral teaching with a social structure that was very much like an aristocracy, with the rule of people on top of other people, so not equal at all. Mm-hmm. But Tocqueville talks about how during the 11th century, the clergy first got political power, and the clergy was open, unlike most political offices, was open to anybody. You could be rich, poor, noble, or a peasant, and you could become a priest. And so that created a kind of open door to bring equality into government, which then spread. You had the spread then of early capitalism. You had commoners making money through business. And then over the course of centuries, those commoners rose, where the aristocrats at the top started sinking because they were involved in wars and lost their relative status compared to the commoners who were rising through capitalism. And so that then is the context in which you have a new kind of much more equal-minded Christianity, namely Puritanism, coming about, and it's the Puritans who settle in North America. Mm-hmm. And then we found a government within that context that holds out natural human equality as one of the highest principles in the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the dynamic that leads to the historical place where Tocqueville is writing his own book.
Yeah. Well, I know you've done work on religion being misused for political gain. Specifically, how does theocratic thinking come into it when we're talking about culture war issues? Does it basically get in the way of the pull of Christianity towards justice?
My main critique of the kind of the religious right and what the role it's tried to play in our politics for the last couple of decades is that it's basically doesn't hold out enough of a separation between Christian teaching and the political order.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of take an Augustinian line on this and say that, you know, that a Christian can have a concern for the common good of the political community in which he lives, but ultimately it's the fate of his own soul that matters more than anything, and mm-hmm. that you should never make the mistake of thinking that your own political community is somehow either too special in the eyes of God, or that the moment you live in is that you can discern exactly what role God might be playing in directing events. I mean, if you're a Christian, you're supposed to believe that God does interfere or play a role behind the scenes, but exactly what that role is and what the end point of it is, we can never know. And I think the religious right makes a mistake in forgetting that lesson of political humility.
Certainly, you would embrace Dr. King's observation that the arc of the universe is bent toward justice.
Yes, I would, although I would say that we don't know where the end point is. Is it 100 years from now, or 5,000 years from now, or 200,000 years? Depending on how far away it is, that will tell us a very different story about how steep that arc really is, if you know what I mean.
I do. Now, I want to know how you internalize this. So in your own mind, when you look at the way in which we're dealing with same-gender marriage now and several other things, do you look at that with hope or with pessimism?
A mixture. I mean, in general, I'm in favor of gay marriage. I think that it's inevitable and that, on the whole, it's better to hold out an ideal of monogamy and devotion among two people,
mm-hmm.
Whether they're heterosexual or homosexual. You know, it's better to say that you should get married than to just be promiscuous with no kind of limitation on mm-hmm. your actions. But by the same token, I mean, Tocqueville was also very concerned and worried the unbelievable power of equality to knock down and transform institutions that we take for granted for thousands of years, and to do it within the course of like a decade or two, as we've seen with marriage since, the late 80s.
Yeah.
Is kind of awe-inspiring and terrifying if you think about it. And it makes you wonder, like, where will this end? Like, what kind of a society will be left once equality has leveled all notions of higher and lower and made everything the same and horizontal, if you will? It's a kind of a chill-inspiring thought.
Yes.
So I place myself kind of in the middle on that question.
Damon Linker is the author of the books, The Theocons and the Religious Test. His article, How Christianity Gave Us Gay Marriage, appeared at theweek.com. We are going to link that from our website. And Damon, it sounds like to me we need to get back together in at least 500 years to see how this works out.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Okay. Later this year, the Peace and Justice Academy in Pasadena, California, will begin its inaugural school year as the first fully accredited, officially interfaith high school in the country. And I don't need to tell you that I find that idea both compelling and very exciting. Joining me now are Kimberly Meedendorp and Randy Christopher, co-executive directors of the Peace and Justice Academy. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Man, I'm fascinated by what you're doing. I'd like for you to start with giving us a little history on the work that you've been doing together for a while now.
We started the Peace and Justice Academy 5 years ago. This is actually our first graduating class of seniors. We have two seniors going off to college. And as we've been building on the work of Peace and Justice, we've been very intentional about diversity. We've been intentional about socioeconomic diversity, ethnic diversity, and Randy and I, about a year and a half ago, looked at each other and realized that we were not representing the diversity of the world's religions, let alone the diversity just within our own community. Pasadena is a very diverse community, and we have a Jewish and a Muslim community in the city, and so we reached out to them to collaborate with them. We've been working with our local Jewish K-8 and Muslim K-8 schools to create a model where we can have an interfaith high school with cooperative ownership, where we don't teach about others or their faith, but we attempt to learn from practitioners of a variety of faith traditions together.
In other words, you invite in representatives of different groups to interact with the students. Is that what you're saying?
Well, we have a faith studies class. In the Christian tradition, we would call that a Bible class.
Right.
And that class has equal weight with any other class in the school, a math class or an English class, social studies. And in our model, this becomes a co-taught class where we have a Muslim scholar, a Jewish scholar, a Christian scholar come in and teach this faith studies class. And it sort of shows up in two ways. The faith studies class is one where the Jewish scholar would work with the Jewish students and the Muslim scholar with the Muslim students, et cetera. But there are also times when the whole school gets together and learns about Judaism or learns about Islam or learns about Christianity. And those parts would also be taught by the scholar from that tradition, as opposed to somebody of the Christian faith teaching you about some other faith.
If I'm understanding you correctly, the Peace and Justice Academy was already in place, and out of your concerns for diversity, you decided then to focus on more pluralism among the students. How does that integrate with a regular high school curriculum?
Well, we started the Peace and Justice Academy, like I said, 5 years ago. We're both from the Mennonite tradition with the idea that peace and justice and community and faith, that these things are integral to helping students solve the problems of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And as we look around the world and we look at the conflicts in the world, we also realize that much of the conflict is being caused by religion, not solved by religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a fully accredited high school. We've mm-hmm. been accredited by our accrediting agency in California. And we have a regular math class. We have a history class. We have an English class. And so what this means, as we've been meeting together with the heads of school from the Jewish and the Muslim school, is establishing a curriculum committee. So obviously in the religious studies, there is a huge change in our curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
But it also means looking at history and making sure we're teaching out of the traditions of the world cultures and the world religions. It also means evaluating the novels we read in English and making sure they're representative of the faith traditions and the other traditions in the world that we want to be aware of and work at reconciling and peace with.
We definitely think that religious diversity is one of the underserved areas in public school. And by the way, we are big advocates of public education, fans of public, supporters of public education. But we also know that no school is perfect for every child.
Mm-hmm.
And if spiritual life is important to a family and to the child, that can't really be encompassed in the public school setting. So we are a parochial school. We are a school that doesn't want to separate a child's faith from everything else that the child learns. So we want to incorporate that in.
So are you funded by Mennonites, or is it broader than that?
We are our own 501c3. We are both from the Mennonite tradition. We are affiliated with the Mennonites, but we have a broad base of supporters from a variety of faith and non-faith traditions,
mm-hmm.
friends of ours who are atheist and agnostic, who are realizing that this really is the model of education that they can support and feel good about.
We are doing something different here in that we've always sort of been a Christian school that's open to people of all faiths or of no faith,
mm-hmm.
but this is different. We are actually ceding ownership of the school to other faith communities. We
mm-hmm.
are partnering with the Jewish community in our area and the Muslim community in our area, and at some point other faith traditions in our area, and that means that we have reconfigured our board to include Muslim and Jewish members on our board. We are working to make our faculty more diverse. And we have this interfaith curriculum committee to look at what we are teaching.
Gosh, how difficult was it to do this?
Well, in some ways, it wasn't difficult at all. We sometimes feel like we are sort of riding the wave of the Spirit here. It all kind of fell into place. The idea has been really welcomed by the Muslim and Jewish community in our area. So it just hasn't been difficult.
Uh-huh. Well, I know what the vision that the two of you had. Were there experiences with students that encouraged you to do this, to pursue this as well?
One of the things that's been interesting, as Randy said, we've been a Christian school open to students of all faith and no faith, and we've really been a different kind of school. We've been very much about the students participating and engaging in their own spiritual journey, wherever that takes them.
Mm-hmm.
And we've looked at the common ethic of peace and justice. We continually remind the students that the golden rule is a tenet of all the world's great religions,
mm-hmm.
that is a common ethic that we can strive to together, and also that we don't need someone else to be wrong for us to be right, and it actually strengthens our faith when we can be in dialogue with others and have to articulate and explain our faith.
So you're going in the wrong direction, because you're supposed to be, if you're right, the other one's wrong.
Right. We have been turning many things on their head with this education.
What kind of responses are you getting in Pasadena?
Well, our parents are thrilled. When we announced it to our parents at a meeting in the direction we were heading, we had several parents just move literally to tears and come up and say, of course, this is the next step for our school, that this is what we should be doing.
Mm.
I also have been really encouraged to have people from other faith traditions and no faith tradition, like I said, friends of mine who are atheists, who are
mm-hmm.
saying, this really is what the spiritual tradition should be doing. This is finally a place where I can look and see the spiritual traditions modeling the path rather than creating a disincentive.
Yeah, we think of ourselves as an experiment in hope over here, right? This is where we want to graduate the next generation of peacemakers.
Yeah, and you're also graduating people who are familiar with the real world. How many students are you going to start with in this way? Is it going to change your enrollment?
We're hoping it increases our enrollment. Our goal for our freshman class for the fall, we have room for 20 students in that class, and our goal is to get 5 Jewish, 5 Muslim, and 5 Christian,
mm-hmm.
and then there is a room for 5 other faiths or no faiths mm-hmm. to come along and participate in this experiment and in hope, with the idea that we will respect those faith traditions and learn about those faith traditions, but it won't be formal instruction until those faith communities could fund that position.
Please tell us and our listeners how to get in touch with you or how to get more information about your school.
Well, the best way to get information is to go to the website, which is www.thepeaceacademy.org. And all the information is on there, and you can see our...
There's contact us information. You can sign up for our email list and our newsletter so that you can be informed as we're rolling out these activities.
Okay, say the website one more time.
www.thepeaceacademy.org.
Now, this is not a fair thing to do, but I need to, I don't have much time left, but I still have a question, and you guys be very brief.
Okay.
What experience did the two of you have that made you devote yourselves to doing this?
For myself, it was coming to realize that Jesus, as the Prince of Peace, was transforming the world. And he wasn't doing it out of a position of strength, but a position of partnership and meeting people in relationship where they are. And that if we don't have relationships with people, we don't know them, we can't understand them, and we can't work together to solve the world's problems.
And right. I always tell the kids that the world's problems, I'll be dead, but it'll be their problem. So I also want to give them some tools to fix those problems.
I've been speaking with Kimberly Mindendorp and Randy Christopher, co-executive directors of the Peace and Justice Academy in Pasadena, California. When the school opens this fall, it will be the first fully accredited interfaith high school in the country. And by the way, when you get going, I want us to touch base again and you let us know how it's going in the classroom. Kimberly and Randy, I thank you so much for what you're doing and also for being willing to tell the listeners of State of Belief Radio what you're doing.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Take care.
So much.
You are on one side and I am on the other. Are we divided?
Now, before we go, here's some words I want to share with you. It's likely you heard something this past week about a bizarre bill that was proposed in Kansas, which would have enshrined in law protections for any and all forms of discrimination against pretty much anyone in a same-sex relationship. Now, bizarre laws are a long-standing American tradition. Right there in Kansas, Topeka forbids serving wine in teacups. You aren't allowed to fall asleep on a train in West Virginia. And Oklahoma bans making ugly faces at dogs. But these are mostly antiquated and forgotten laws, quaint, funny, and rarely, if ever, enforced. Well, the Kansas State Assembly, which voted overwhelmingly in favor of the law I mentioned, before it was mercifully withdrawn, was expressing its support for a new and ugly breed of bigotry. Not only should it be unthinkable to overtly legitimize bias against our fellow Americans, it's even more odious to do it in the name of religious freedom. Among the insightful responses to this was a commentator who pointed out that followers of the Mormon faith abstain from alcohol and coffee on religious grounds. Yet there is no restriction on a Mormon restaurant server, for example, providing these substances to patrons. Doing so has no relationship to their religious freedom. Well, right now, as we speak, there is a bloody religious civil war happening in the Central African Republic. After a brutal Muslim government killed a number of Christian civilians there, a bloody backlash has Christian vigilantes slaughtering Muslim families. That is what a threat to religious freedom really looks like. That is where efforts to protect rights and lives ought to be focused. The callous perversity of ignoring ongoing faith-based genocide while attempting to suborn the language of religious liberty in the service of small-mindedness is nothing less than evil. And the fact that a majority of an American state's legislative body thinks that this is what its citizenry wants should be a warning to all of us about how far down this slippery slope we've already come. If this kind of bill can be considered and supported, then sadly the difficult work of dehumanizing those who are different is already done. And once it's done, the way those who are different get marginalized, be it in the name of family values, religious freedom, or wine in teacups, is really just a matter of degree. And that should be terrifying. Religion and the language of religion are among the most powerful forces in civilization. Now more than ever, each of us bears a responsibility to ensure it is never used to justify dehumanizing any of us. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. We can only produce this show with the generous support of listeners like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution to support our show today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, sign up for our podcasts. Stay in touch with us, please, throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. The listener line is 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen also. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. Preacher man, the only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.